It was an early evening meeting, and Yasmin and her father took the subway to Midtown Manhattan after school. They exited the elevator and found the offices empty except for the attorney, who invited them in. Yasmin was impressed by the stately, reserved elegance of the place. A Muslim lawyer, she thought. That's awesome. He sat them down in a boardroom with a big oak table and asked Yasmin to explain the story. She immediately launched in by describing the Equal Access Act and the basics of contract law. Just explain the story to me, he said patiently.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. This week, we join Mustafa Bayoumi as he reads from his new book, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, Being Young and Arab in America? Bayoumi is himself young and Arab. He began writing the book at a frightening moment when hate crimes against Arabs and Muslims spiked 1,700%. And a poll conducted by Gallup and USA Today found that almost 40% of Americans believe that all Muslims, U.S. citizens included, should be forced to carry special IDs. Mustafa Bayoumi lives in New York. He was born in Switzerland, raised in Canada, and earned his PhD at Columbia University. Now he's an English professor at Brooklyn College, with a knack for writing both for academics and a general audience. You may have read some of Bayoumi's writings in such magazines as The Nation, New York Magazine, or the London Review of Books. This reading of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem took place in August 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much, Carla, and good evening to you all. And it's a real pleasure to be here at Politics and Prose to introduce my book to you. The book is entitled How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? One could answer that simply, I guess, with, you know, well, it sucks. But that would be a very short book. So I decided to look at it a little more deeply than that. I began by thinking about that title, with Du Bois obviously echoing in my brain, the souls of black folk echoing there. And if you know anything about the souls of black folk, I'm sure many of you have read it, a classic work in American letters from 1903, written really during the height of Jim Crow, during official segregation, during a time in American history when two different populations, African Americans and the wider American society, were really legally separated from each other and didn't have any contact, really substantial human contact with each other, right? So Du Bois ends up writing this book, this very eloquent, beautiful book, The Souls of Black Folk, as he says, to lift the veil between populations, right? To show, in a sense, the wider experience of in a wider lens, what the African-American experience is to the general American public. And it seemed to me, somehow, 100 years later, 104, 105 years later, that it was appropriate to take another look at that book by Du Bois and rethink that book in a sense, or at least some of the framing questions of that book as it applies to Arab and Muslim Americans today in the wake of the war on terrorism. Now, in no way, I just do want to make it clear, though, in no way am I saying that, you know, what's happened since September 11, as terrible as it has been in many instances, but not all, as you'll see if you read my book, does that equate to, you know, the history of what African Americans have gone through in the United States. I'm not trying to appropriate another history here, obviously. Slavery and segregation, entrenched discrimination, that's all a deep part of American history that has to be recognized. But I am thinking, I think, in terms of how racial difference works, how racial formation works in the United States. And so I wanted to think about the Du Bois question, framing it when it comes to Arab Americans and Muslim Americans. And then there was another reason also for choosing the Du Bois, which was in Brooklyn, where my book is set. There's a lot of affinity, really, between young African Americans and young Arab Americans, between black and Latino culture and Arab American culture, increasingly, especially at the younger level. So it also felt natural, felt correct, in a sense, to draw those connections. So let me tell you a little bit about my book, though. Fundamentally, it's a book of stories. It's about seven different young people, all between the ages of 18 and 30, all who have lived in Brooklyn or live in Brooklyn. In my book, there are three women and four men, and all of them are Arab Americans. Six out of the seven are Muslim Arab Americans. Of course, most Arab Americans in the United States are Christian, and I talk about that as well in the beginning of the book. Thank you. But I decided to focus, to concentrate my book on Muslim Arab Americans, since they're really the ones that are in the eye of the storm, as you could say, today. Right? The one story that I do have of a Christian Arab American is about Sammy, who's a Marine who fought two tours in Iraq. And even his story has repercussions for what it means to be a Muslim Arab American, insofar as he's connecting with assumptions that people have of him as being Muslim, even though he's Christian because he's Arab, or the assumptions that his fellow Arab Muslim friends will have of him since he fought in the war. I'll get to that in a second. Okay. So what I thought I would do today is tell you a little bit about each of the stories to hopefully tantalize you a little bit, and also tell you about why I chose Brooklyn as a location for my book. And it seemed to me that what I really wanted to get at in this book also was the complications of lived experience. I don't really come to this book with a lot of ideology or, you know, an agenda, as it were. I was looking for how people actually live their lives. I wasn't really looking for stories that were about heroes or villains exclusively, people who have only suffered or people who are only triumphant, but really about all the different kinds of shades of gray in life. And it seemed to me much more important than to think about lived experience, about the concreteness of life. So in order to do that, I thought it's much better for me to locate my book in a specific setting, and that setting is Brooklyn. For one thing, it's because, of course, I live in Brooklyn, so I didn't have to travel for the book. But also because Brooklyn, I think, means a lot to me. It also, of course, is in the proximity of the World Trade Center and Ground Zero, as they call it today. And New York itself is a very vibrant, alive place. So let me read you a little bit about why I chose Brooklyn, which is from the introduction of my book. Brooklyn, incidentally, too, in the 2000 census, the U.S. Census Bureau, for the first time, enumerated Arab Americans. And so they said that the largest Arab American community, according to the U.S. Census, was in New York City. And Brooklyn has the largest number within New York City. So that was another reason why to choose Brooklyn. Yet far more important than base numbers, I write, is the borough itself. Brooklyn is chiefly no whole or recognizable animal, writes James Aggie, but an exorbitant pulsing mass of scarcely discernible cellular jellies and tissue. With more than 2.5 million residents, it is the third largest metropolitan area in the country. Size alone does not account for its energy. Robber barons, refugees, free blacks, and the international working class have all settled here, whether in leafy Victorian mansions or in limestone, brownstone, or federal-style row houses, making the story of Brooklyn a short history of human escape and reinvention flattened through geography and narrated through architecture. Walt Whitman once called it the city of homes and churches, and yet it is more. A country on its own, Brooklyn continuously repopulates itself, first by boat and ferry, and now by the plane loads of the world's exiles and emigres, and it brims with all the rhythms and pageantry of 21st century American life. Today, Brooklyn is Prospect Heights with its late-night barbershops, all fabulous hair and atomic light at 12 a.m. Or Coney Island, a seasonal experiment in radical democracy held in a riot of colors and soundtrack to amusement park songs. It's the Friday afternoon call to prayer in Bedford-Stuyvesant. Brooklyn is a tourist-free Chinatown in Sunset Park, or the dollar stores of Flatbush Avenue that spill their wares onto the noisy street and away from their weeping, scarred, and aching buildings. It's dreadlocked West Indians flying kites in Prospect Park, or the colony of Middle American defectors in Williamsburg, urban hipsters costumed in androgynous jeans and monotonous tattoos. It's the bourgeoisie of Brooklyn Heights, living in stately grace but with barely suppressed feelings of self-loathing for not owning a 212 area code. Brooklyn is the slowly dissolving Italian hub of Bensonhurst, the Syrian Jews of Ocean Parkway, and the Pakistanis of Coney Island Avenue. It is the birds of Greenwood Cemetery singing their songs to the Civil War dead. upper crust Haitians living well in Midwood Estates and intrepid diners visiting Bay Ridge's transplanted Mediterranean coast, where high on the old Nordic Third Avenue, sea air mingles with the garlic aromas floating out of the Arab, Greek, and Italian eateries that line the street. Brooklyn is the informal urban apartheid of Eastern Parkway, the soft socialism of Park Slope, the Russian capitalism of Brighton Beach. It's the salt marshes of Marine Park, the roast beef sandwiches on Nostrand Avenue, DeFerris Pizza, Vox Pop, and Vinegar Hill. Brooklyn is the dangerous rush of traffic on Atlantic Avenue, where bus exhaust mixes with the smells of fresh bread and Arabic spices. It's the madness of Pacific Street, where parents seek refuge from the urban cacophony in its tiny community garden, and Dean Street, where the Chinese food is halal. It's true. I didn't make that. Nothing's made up. Brooklyn, I write, is the concentrated, unedited 21st century answer to who we, as Americans, are as a people. So after setting my book in Brooklyn, I decided, the chronology's a little off. I wrote that after I'd found the stories. But I have 7 stories in the book. So let me tell you very briefly what the stories are about. The first story, Russia, is about a woman who was detained with her whole family about 6 months after 9/11 in one of these mass arrests that happened after 9/11. I'm not sure if you're aware, but people estimate, the law professor David Cole estimates at least 5,000 people were basically arrested without just cause after 9/11. And the Office of Inspector General of the Attorney General's Office issued a report saying basically the same thing, essentially the same thing. So her family is one story, and her in particular is one story about that detention. The second story is the one I mentioned earlier briefly, Sammy, who's the Arab-American who decides one day that he's not going anywhere in school, he doesn't know what he wants to do, he's bored out of his mind, he's going to join the Marines. He gets a call from a recruiter, some of his friends had joined the Marines, he decides to join the Marines. It's early 2001. So he does basic training, and then on the night of September 10th, he boards a bus in New York City to go to his Marine combat training. And then, of course, it's an overnight bus. The next day, they find out what happened, and everything changes. They know that, they're going to go to war. He had joined the military for entirely other reasons, and how he fights 2 tours in Iraq during this time. And actually, something interesting happens to Sammy, as I tell it in the story, in the book, is that he is not that Arab identified in his life in the U.S., but as he goes to Iraq and he fights, he becomes more interested in his Arab identity. And so you get some sense of that in the chapter. And then he comes back, and he starts to associate with some Arab Americans who are in the college where he goes, and they don't want to have that much to do with him because he fought in Iraq. The third story is a story about a young woman, Yasmin, who in high school, she's very ambitious, and she decided that she was going to run for student government. She succeeded as a freshman, and she actually won a position of secretary. And yet there was something that stood in her way. Because one of the duties that she hadn't been told about beforehand was that all student officers had to attend all school events, and that included school dances. Now, she's a religious woman. She covers her hair. She said that she doesn't think she can go to the school dances. The school essentially forced her to resign her position. So she then fights with all the muster and energy that a 15-year-old or 16-year-old can to overturn the school's decision. And I'm not going to tell you how it turns out. Okay. So then the fourth story is Akram. Each chapter is named just simply for the person whose story it is. And Akram is a young Palestinian-American who works in his father's grocery store. His father came from the West Bank in the early 70s with nothing and is, through almost a quintessentially American dream type story, labored his way through working in other people's grocery stores. If you know anything about Brooklyn, you know that the grocery store is a central location for Arab-American life. A lot of the small corner grocery stores are run by Arab Americans. So his father is one of these stories, and he's able to essentially buys a store, and he provides for his family through the store. And the kids work, he has 2 boys who work in the store. They work there all the time, 90 hours a week during the summer, 65 hours a week during the school year, constantly, constantly working. It takes a real commitment to run those stores. And then another story is Lina, who is an Iraqi-American, and she has a very complicated story that involves all these different loves of her life and conservative parents that she's constantly battling. At the same time that the 2 men in her life end up being coming from one, they're both Iraqi, one is from a dissident family, and the other one, as it turns out, ends up being arrested as a spy for Saddam Hussein. Then the fifth story is about Omar, who worked in as an intern, he worked in Al Jazeera. And he wanted to do media. He was a communications major in school. He was very, very excited about this internship. He felt it gave him all kinds of street cred amongst his Arab American friends that he's working in Al Jazeera. And he thought that this would be his launching pad to a career in the media. And so he started, after the internship was finished, he started handing out resumes and trying to get a job, and he couldn't get a job. Nobody was calling him back. So he was convinced that maybe the Al Jazeera, which he thought was going to be his ticket out, was actually blacklisting him from his work. And the last chapter is Rami. Rami is a young man, young Palestinian American, whose father was also picked up by the authorities. They had placed an informant in the grocery store where he was working, and in that store they were doing some illicit cigarette smuggling. You know, one of the things that the government did after 9/11 was they went after all the grocery stores, all what they called small scams. They looked for small scams because they were really targeting the community in all kinds of ways. So the father got caught up in all of these immigration procedures. I'm just going to read very briefly. I'll read a little bit from Yasmin's story to give you a sense of that. And then we'll move to question and answer. Yasmin was trying, as I described her story earlier, was trying very much to overturn the school's decision, and she was hitting all kinds of brick walls. No one was listening to her, and she did all this legal research on her own. You know, she went to the public library, she took out this book, Sue the Bastards, Law for Dummies, all these different things. She was trying to learn exactly what to do. Finally, a local lawyer, a Muslim lawyer, said that maybe he was interested in her case, and he said, come and meet me. So she comes with her father to meet this lawyer. That's where I'm going to pick up the story. It was an early evening meeting, and Yasmin and her father took the subway to Midtown Manhattan after school. They exited the elevator and found the offices empty except for the attorney, who invited them in. Yasmin was impressed by the stately, reserved elegance of the place. A Muslim lawyer, she thought. That's awesome. He sat them down in a boardroom with a big oak table and asked Yasmin to explain the story. She immediately launched in by describing the Equal Access Act and the basics of contract law. Just explain the story to me, he said patiently. So she did. She took out her smiley face folder and detailed how she had won the election, been forced to resign, lost her right to run again, and everything else that had happened. He took notes on a yellow legal pad as she spoke, interspersed with nodding his head or humming assent. Yasmin finished, and then he spoke, first offering the now 17-year-old some advice. Whenever anyone said something related to the case, he told her, she should note what was said, the speaker, and the date. Yasmin listened with open ears and canyon-wide eyes. That will be your evidence, he said, and Yasmin nodded. So what should we do? She asked, almost holding her breath. He thought they had a case, he said, and she began breathing again. He couldn't promise they would win, he said, but there was a case to be made here, one that the courts would decide. And then he started talking about money. He told Yasmin and her father that a lower court decision would require a $6,000 retainer. If it moved to a higher court, fees might reach $10,000 to $12,000. And he kept walking up the litigation ladder with higher fees and higher courts while Yasmin nodded and her father said nothing. The meeting ended. Think about it, he said, as he showed them out. You know how to contact me. For the first time, the thought hit Yasmin. Wait. Is my dad going to pay for this? He'd said it was worth it, she'd surmised, so he'd probably pay. Outside, Yasmin was bubbling with excitement over the meeting. She turned to her father. What do you think, Baba? They were walking to the subway, descending the stairs. It's a good case, Habibti, her father said. But I have four daughters. I have to put you all through college. I can't pay $12,000 to $20,000 to bring a case to court that might lose. They waited on the platform, and suddenly Yasmin felt her imminent victory sliding away. But Baba, she pleaded, it's for a good cause. It's for all the Muslims. If it becomes a good law, then it applies everywhere. She had learned this from her legal research. The subway roared in, all rattling noise and clanging steel. Think of the money, Yasmin. It wouldn't be fair to your sisters. They have to go to school, too. He paused, and the conductor announced, stand clear of the closing doors, please. "We'll think about it," he said, which in Egyptian parent speak, as Yasmin well knew, really means no. In February, Yasmin took the lawyer's advice to heart. She was sitting in leadership class when the coordinator of student affairs explained that he was the one who basically had forced her to resign. He's a faculty member. Explained that since Greek Easter begins on a Friday, Greek students in leadership would be excused from a bodybuilding event to be held on a weekend in May. In addition to dances, Yasmin didn't attend the school's bodybuilding contests, which she described in an email as, quote, "a show of half-naked contestants flexing their muscles, which I feel is inappropriate." She scribbled a note on a piece of paper, beginning with the date and the time of the coordinator of student affairs' comment. 2-4-0-2, 12:41 p.m., Greeks, Good Friday Greaster, will be excused for religious obligations. And then she quoted the coordinator on student affairs. "For religious obligations, I'm willing to make exceptions once in a while." She recalled when the e-board changed the date of a dance so it wouldn't conflict with one girl's private party and wrote underneath, "Sweet 16, not a religious holiday, duh. Make one exception, 5, follow." Later, she found out that the executive board had put her on a maybe list to get kicked out of leadership. Thank you.
With these people in these 7 cases,
yeah,
did you have any trouble gaining their confidence?
For some people, it took a little longer than others, but no trouble. Really. It just took some time. The way that I found the people is when I first had the idea for the book, I went to some of the community associations, I talked to community lawyers, I went to the mosques, I talked to imams. That helped to some degree. But mostly I talked to my friends and they talked to their friends and so on, as the old shampoo commercial says it. Right. So sociologists will call that a snowball sample. They do. That's the official term, a snowball sample. But I wasn't really interested in sociology. I was really interested in just finding the best stories that I could tell. So I was interested in finding people who had full stories that had a narrative arc to them. That's what I wanted to get at. So once I started telling people that I was writing this book, people started giving me all of their different experiences. And a lot of those were very interesting, but they were more the sort of minor indignities, small things that had happened to them here or there. And I put a few of them in the book. But I was really interested in the people who had the best story to tell from a narrative point of view. I also saw this as a kind of writerly project, to sort of think about how I can write about these people's lives. And so that's why I wanted to get those kinds of stories as well.
Thank you for your talk. I noticed that you focus a lot on youth. Most of the people that you interview, men and women, are younger.
Yeah.
I was wondering, first of all, why you chose that, and also if you could talk about family life, for example, parent-child relations and sibling relations, and grandparents' relations with them, and if you think that any of this changed post 9/11.
Okay. Yes, youth is definitely also a character in the book, I think. I think of it as a character, the same way that I think Brooklyn is the setting and youth is a character. And the reason why I wanted to look at youth for this book was, multiple. For one thing, it seems to me that the young people have all kinds of expectations that are put on them. They are trying to forge a better future. They're forging ahead. They have a lot of expectations that they put on themselves and that their families have for them to succeed and to gain respect for themselves and their families and their communities. The communities put some pressure on them to put the good name of the community out there in an era where it's increasingly difficult, et cetera, et cetera. So they have that burden on them. At the same time, that young Arabs and Muslims are also, I think, especially the men, are the ones that are most feared by the general culture. So they live somewhere in between these two expectations. And they make fun of the association with terrorism all the time. They use humor as a way of defeating it, right? And so it seemed to me very important to think about youth for its kind of contradictions and its complexity. And the other thing is that it's a young community in general, and September 11 was now almost 7 years to the day, right? So I have some memory of what it was like, of course, before. I know what it's as an adult. I had an identity, an already formed identity, about what it meant to be me, what it meant to be Arab, Muslim, all of these things prior to September 11. And then September 11 happened, and then you can use that as a way of understanding your world. But for many of these people that I was talking to in my book, September 11 is their whole adult reality. And so that, too, I think is very foundational. It's very important to underline.
Thank you very much for a very fascinating presentation. I'm really delighted that you're shedding light on new eras in the U.S., but I have no idea what's going on. But learning from you that there's a large youth group, there's this youth phase, problem with unemployment, and they're struggling. These are the same thing that we have seen in Paris, we see it in Copenhagen, and it actually explodes. If you pair this information with the fact that you mentioned to us that 5,000 people have been rounded up,
yeah.
Why is this not explosive? Why yeah. is this youth not rallying up and doing what we have seen in Paris and in yeah. Copenhagen and elsewhere?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's an excellent question, to think about the comparisons you know, in other geographies as well. And I appreciate the framing of the question, because I think that one of the most important things when you're talking about these kinds of issues today is to really, I think, place the communities inside of their own national contexts, rather than talking about them as a kind of global or international phenomenon where everybody has the same mindset. Because the national realities really dictate the differences, I think. And so it has a lot to do with how American society is run, how French society is run, how British society is run. Those things are very important. They have a lot of impact on these. So I think that there are many, many different reasons, too, and I can detail a few, because I also think that you can't have, I'm afraid, you can't have an easy answer. There's not just one answer, but there are several layers to it, I think. The first is a question of class and integration, right? In Europe, basically, the Muslim populations who have come from different parts of the Muslim world, who are working in these parts of Europe, they were brought in as a laboring class, and they were never really integrated more than they were never really wanted for anything else but their labor. Whereas the United States is a little bit different, because the United States is essentially, at its heart, it's a colonial settler society. It wants people to come here, and it has a different kind of ethos about people coming here. This immigration history, its immigration mythology is very different. And that actually does play a big role. That's one. I think another thing is there's a very different relationship of religion in the United States with, say, France, right? If you think about France as an example, in the United States you have the separation between church and state, as you do in France, right? But in the United States, you are separating the church and state because you're protecting the church from the state. That's the religious persecution fleeing, coming to the United States, you're protecting the church from the state in the United States. That's why that separation exists. In France, it's the other way around. It's protecting the state from the church. That's why you had a revolution. So you need to think about, you know, how these different things play out. Thirdly, you could also talk about the fact that I think that there are many different histories of political violence that people can latch onto in Europe that they can't latch onto for whatever reasons in the United States. So that are very recent and proximate, right? So in England, you have the IRA. In Spain, you have Basque, the ETA, right? In France, you have the Corsicans. You have, like, you know, this kind of stuff happens routinely. Whereas in the United States, it's not part of our political memory. It's not part of our political vocabulary. Maybe that's a good thing, but it's not, right? I remember I watched that documentary. I mean, sure, it's a good thing, but I watched that documentary on the Weather Underground a few years back. I don't know if any of you saw that. Just a fabulous documentary. And they're going through, and there's this one segment in it where it's like, you know, there was this bombing and that bombing and this bombing and that bombing in the early 70s. And your jaw just kind of goes, it drops, and you say, well, I did. It's like, really? This happened? You know, it's not part of our vocabulary. Whereas in the United Kingdom or other places, it's been present for a very long time that's a terrible, immoral, horrific way of political speech. So I think that there are many different layers that are attached to it, you know, alienation and exclusion. The United States has a different philosophy towards those things. And so on the one level, I think in the domestic sphere, those are the major differences, you know. And on the other level, you know, so it's become very complicated to, I think, exist in the Western context as a Muslim, say. Because in the United States, too, but at the same time that you have this relatively open and relatively accepting society here, although I think there are problems and I detail them in my book, but my book is actually quite optimistic about the United States as a whole. internally, domestically. But then you have the United States as this foreign power, which with this really terrible foreign policy, as far as I'm concerned. What's different, I think, about the Arab-American and the Muslim-American situation, maybe it's not that different, but it's somewhat different than a lot of other ethnic groups, or at least in the American imagination, is that the history of a lot of other ethnic groups in the United States is about domestic policy. Their exclusion is because of certain things in domestic policy that they face. Whereas the fate of the Arab and the Muslim communities in the United States is basically hinged on American foreign policy. I mean, obviously, what happened to the Japanese also was on another degree of horror compared to what happened for the 5,000 people or more who were detained post 9/11. There's no comparison, but there is some similarity. One can draw intellectual similarities between them, I think, and one should. I think that there's a lot, great deal to be gained by looking at these sort of comparative ethnic groups and on trying to understand how American society as a whole deals with these questions. And what I say in my book is that the Arabs and the Muslims are now the newest minorities in the American imagination. Because it seems to me that what's really important also to think about is that this is all a post-civil rights phenomenon. And we'd somehow, maybe it's not very naive on my part, but at least be very conscious about racial formation and racism and these sorts of things. And the speed by which it could happen again seems a little troubling to me.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings and discussions like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.